Broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain, BC, we are CJSF 90.1 FM, and we are diverse, independent, and yours.
The Kissingerism is so hard to pin down, I think, as an effect of Kissingerism, of the rehabilitation of the national security state and the relentless militarism that goes with it, constant, unending war, be it fought with neocon zealotry or drone-like efficiency, has done more than caution thought and morality. I think it's brought about a disassociation of words and things, beliefs and actions, in which abstractions are transmuted into their opposites. According to Clinton, Hillary Clinton, idealists are realists, and everybody is liberal, and Henry Kissinger is our avatar.
That's Greg Grandin, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Greg Grandin on Kissingerisms. Turning 100, the accolades for Henry Kissinger are pouring in. He is a legend. Over decades, he has assiduously cultivated and constructed the image of the sagacious elder statesman. Corporate journalists hang on his every word. Politicians seek his advice. But what is his record to deserve such respect and reverence? He's one of the most notorious characters of this or any other period in history. Ask the Kurds, the East Timorese, the Bangladeshis, the Laotians, and the Chileans what they think of the Nobel Peace Prize laureate. But since they are unpeople, their opinions don't count. When he was Nixon's national security advisor, Kissinger displayed his kowtowing to power when he kept silent as his boss made anti-Semitic remarks. When Nixon demanded that Cambodia be bombed, he conveyed the order like a good errand boy. It was Kissinger who once boasted, "The illegal we do immediately, the unconstitutional takes a little longer." To talk about Henry Kissinger is Greg Grandin, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He's professor of history at Yale. He's the author of The End of the Myth, The Blood of Guatemala, and Kissinger's Shadow. His articles appear in the Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The New York Times. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at the University of Montana in 2015. And now, Greg Grandin.
I'd like to start with a headline from the Associated Press, August 9th, 1973, that unfortunately sounds as if it could be from last week. And the headline is, "Bombing of Hospitals Called Routine." That headline introduced a story that Congress was holding hearings on clandestine activities, air activities and ground activities in Cambodia and Laos, and it reported that U.S. commanders in Vietnam placed no restrictions on ground or air attacks against either Viet Cong or North Vietnamese hospitals. In testimony and in letters from veterans, it was reported that hospitals were often considered targets rather than areas to be avoided. In one testimony by Alan Stevenson, who was a stockbroker from San Francisco, but he was also a former Army intelligence specialist, Stevenson reported that while he was in the Quang Tri province in 1969, he routinely listed hospitals among targets to be struck by American fighter planes. "The bigger the hospital, the better it was," Stevenson testified. He said that he believed hospitals were rated highly as potential targets, not because American commanders wanted to attack wounded enemy troops, but because hospital complexes were often protected by company or battalion-sized troop units. And in Cambodia, too, the U.S. targeted hospitals. A letter from one former Army captain said that in 1969 and 1970, his job was analyzing aerial photographs from B-52 bombs dropped on Cambodia, and he saw on several occasions where hospitals had been bombed. Another Air Force captain, another former aircraft captain, Gerald Grieven, said that he personally ordered bombing raids against hospitals. It was policy, he said, to, quote, "look for hospitals as targets." The report also noted that General Creighton Abrams, who was then the Army Chief of Staff and a former commander of U.S. forces in Vietnam, had testified to Congress that he had carried out a false reporting system designed to cover up the illegal bombing of Cambodia between 1969 and 1970. He said he didn't create the double bookkeeping system that he testified about. He said at one point there were so many different authorizations and reporting systems being applied to the secret covert operations that he had trouble keeping things straight himself. The AP report then went on to say that congressional investigators were stymied trying to, quote, determine who ordered a dual reporting system in which 3,630 B-52 raids over Cambodia between 1969 and 1970 were recorded falsely as having occurred in South Vietnam. And that person that wasn't identified in 1973, but was identified later by the investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, was Henry Kissinger. Richard Nixon was inaugurated in January 20th, 1969. And a month later, on February 24th, Kissinger, his national security advisor, and Kissinger's military aide, General Alexander Haig, met with the colonel in the Air Force, Ray Sinton, to begin the planning of Operation Menu, as the code name for the bombing of Cambodia was called. Menu had to be kept absolutely secret because Nixon, elected promising to end the conflict, feared the public backlash that an escalation of the war into Cambodia might provoke. Secrecy was also required to circumvent Congress, which exercised its power over the armed services largely through the appropriations of funds needed to conduct specific missions. Many, including Nixon and Kissinger, felt that Congress wouldn't approve the bombing of Cambodia since Cambodia was a neutral country and that the United States wasn't at war with. So Kissinger, Haig, and Sinton came up with a simple but very comprehensive deception. Based on recommendations received from Vietnam, Sinton would work up the targets in Cambodia to be struck. Then he would bring them to Kissinger in the White House for approval. Kissinger was very hands-on, Ray Sinton recalled in an oral history. He revised some of Sinton's work. Once Kissinger was satisfied with the proposed targets, the coordinates would be back-channeled to Saigon, and from there a courier would pass them on to the appropriate radar stations, where an officer would make a last-minute switch. B-52s would be diverted from its cover target in South Vietnam into Cambodia, and then it would drop its bomb load on the real target in Cambodia, not South Vietnam. When the run was completed, the officer in charge of the deception on the ground would burn whatever documents, maps, computer printouts, radar reports, messages, and so on, that might reveal the actual target. A whole special furnace was set up in South Vietnam to dispose of the records of the bombing targets that was kept going day and night. One colonel who was a whistleblower who led to the revealing of this story in 1973 testified that every piece of paper, including scratch paper, the paper that one of our computers might have done some figuring on, every piece of scrap paper was gathered up. I would wait until daylight, and as soon as that time came, I would go out and burn all of the paperwork. He would then write up false post-strike paperwork indicating that the South Vietnam sortie was flown as planned. That way, Congress and Pentagon administrators would be provided phony target reports and other forged data so as to account for actual expenditures, fuel, bombs, and spare parts, without ever having to reveal that Cambodia was the actual target. Now, when I told friends and colleagues that I was writing a book about the legacy of Henry Kissinger, and particularly Kissinger's focusing a good deal on Kissinger in Cambodia, many made mention of another book that some of you here may know, Christopher Hitchens' The Trial of Henry Kissinger. But I saw my purpose as somewhat antithetical to Hitchens' polemic, which I think is a good example of what the great historian Charles Beard called a devil's theory of war. According to Beard, a devil's theory of war is one that places all of the blame for militarism on a single, isolatable cause, a wicked man, in Beard's phrase. To really understand the sources of conflict, Beard said, you had to look at the big picture, to consider the way war is our own work, emerging out of the total military and economic situation. In making the case that Kissinger should be tried and convicted for war crimes, Hitchens didn't look at the big picture. Instead, he focused obsessively on the morality of one man, his devil, Henry Kissinger. Yet aside from assembling the docket and gathering the accused's wrongdoings in one place, the trial of Henry Kissinger is not very useful, and I think it's actually counterproductive. Righteous indignation doesn't provide much room for critical thinking. Hitchens burrows deep into Kissinger's dark heart. The statesman was implicated in horrors in Cambodia, Laos, Bangladesh, Vietnam, East Timor, Latin America, Southern Africa, Sheridan's Circle in Washington, against the Kurds in the Middle East. Hitchens leaves readers waiting for him to come out and tell us what it all means. That is, besides the obvious, that Kissinger is a war criminal. But Hitchens never does. And most students of Henry Kissinger find it hard to say anything about Kissinger that isn't about Kissinger. He's such an outsized figure that he eclipses his own context. He leading as many biographers, critics, and admirers to focus nearly exclusively on the quirks of his personality or his moral failings. Now, Seymour Hersh's 1983, The Price of Power, Kissinger in the Nixon White House, did capture the secretive world of the national security apparatus as it was functioning during the Vietnam War. And his study of Kissinger's paranoia reads like a somewhat innocent prelude to the all-pervading surveillance and counterterrorism state that we all now live under. Hersh gave us the defining portrait of Kissinger as a preening paranoid, tacking back and forth between ruthlessness and sycophancy to advance his career, cursing his fate and letting fly the B-52s. In Hersh's hands, he's small in his vanities, he's shabby in his motives, but Kissinger is nonetheless Shakespearean because his pettiness gets played out on the world stage with epic consequences. But Hersh, writing in the early 1980s, couldn't know the long-term effects, not only of specific policies, but of how Kissinger's imperial, what I call is imperial existentialism, and I'll come back to that term, previewed a later generation of militarists who in the 1990s, after a quick detour through Central America and Panama, would lead us deeper into the Gulf, and then after 9/11, into Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, Henry Kissinger is 100 years old, and his life runs through the decades like a bright red line, shedding light on the road that has brought us to where we now find ourselves, from Vietnam and Cambodia to Persian Gulf. Now, let me stress here that I do not hold Kissinger to be singularly responsible for the evolution of the national security state in the United States into what it's become, a kind of perpetual motion machine. But his extended career does illuminate that evolution like nobody else's. In particular, Kissinger was a key player during a transformative moment of the imperial presidency in the 1960s, and his career overlaps with a very consequential moment in U.S. history. In the 1960s and 70s, when the Vietnam War undermined the traditional foundations on which the old national security state stood on since at least the early years of the Cold War, those foundations were elite planning, bipartisanship, bipartisan consensus, and public support. Now, the unraveling of America's long mid-century domestic consensus, which ran from about 1941 to 1966, had begun earlier under Lyndon Johnson and had many causes, civil rights movement, political economy of the United States, student protests, and other foreign policies. But Nixon and Kissinger took the crisis to a new level. The illegal bombing of an invasion of Cambodia, of which Kissinger was the architect and executor, kicked off a series of events, including the killing of protesters in Kent State and Jackson Universities, that led directly to Watergate and to Nixon's resignation in 1974. Paranoia fueled paranoia. Crimes led to more crimes. Today, Watergate is largely remembered as a domestic scandal, but it was really about foreign policy, namely the desire to keep the mad bombing of Cambodia secret. And it was Kissinger, more than any other Nixon staffer, who got Nixon riled up about Daniel Ellsberg's 1971 leaking of the Pentagon Papers. Reading the transcripts and of the conversations that went on in the White House, you could see how Kissinger was very instrumental in getting Nixon worked up about Ellsberg. You know, the Pentagon Papers were not particularly incriminating about the Nixon administration. They stopped their history under the Johnson administration. But Kissinger was fearful that Ellsberg, if he had access to the Pentagon Papers, also had access to information about Operation Menu. So he was very determined to get Nixon to act on Ellsberg. Curse that son of a bitch. I know him well, he began one Oval Office meeting. He's a despicable bastard. Ehrlichman remembered Kissinger as being passionate in his denunciation of Ellsberg. Kissinger keyed his performance to stir up Nixon's various resentments. He depicted Ellsberg as some kind of liberal and hedonistic Superman. He was smart, subversive, perverse, and privileged. There's not any one moment we can identify that kicks off the chain of events that leads to Watergate, but there's one line in some of these transcripts, in one of the transcripts when they were discussing Ellsberg, that I like to think of as the moment where Nixon lost it, and that's when Kissinger tells Nixon, you know, he's married a very rich girl. You know, there's something about that line that those who know is Nixon's various resentments, the idea that Ellsberg was somehow sexually promiscuous and got the girls, was key to stir up Nixon's resentments. You know, Ehrlichman said Nixon was fascinated. Henry got Nixon cranked up, and then they started cranking each other up until they were in a frenzy. It shows you're a weakling, Mr. President, Kissinger told Ellsberg, if you were to let Ellsberg get away with it. And then crimes led to more crimes. Kissinger was involved in many of the early plotting, including wiretaps placed on close friends and associates, the surveillances and meetings where the nation's highest officers smeared anti-war dissidents as treasonous elites and gave orders to run paramilitary black bag operations, including the break-in of Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office in California in order to find incriminating evidence. There's one meeting where Kissinger and Nixon and Haldeman are sitting around, and they're discussing figuring out ways that they could blackmail Lyndon Johnson into coming out to denouncing Ellsberg. I mean, the idea of a sitting president sitting around with, you know, his inner circle discussing blackmailing the previous president, it's quite a scene. Yet even as Vietnam and Watergate was breaking up the old national security state, Kissinger, who would survive Watergate and continue on in his position as National Security Advisor and Secretary of State under Gerald Ford, was helping with its reconstruction in a new form, a restored imperial presidency capable of moving forward in a post-Vietnam world. So that's one of the arguments of the book, that Kissinger simultaneously presides over the crack-up and the undoing of the old national security state, even as he's working to kind of reconstitute it on new footings that one would find familiar, you know, look through the prism of today. You know, there's different elements of this new security state. I'll just list three of them. One is the increased dependence on secrecy and covert action to bypass what had become a meddlesome Congress, an inquisitive press corps, and a skeptical public, and a dissenting public. Kissinger's off the books, not just operations in Cambodia, but his support of insurgencies and proxy wars in southern Africa in many ways provided a template for the Reagan administration's expansion of similar clandestine operations in Nicaragua throughout the Third World, including in Nicaragua, Iran-Contra, for instance. Another element of the new restored national security state is the increasing use of militarism to leverage domestic polarization. So if polarization, domestic polarization, is leading to the crack-up of the national security state, politicians and increasingly use foreign policy to leverage that polarization to their advantage. Robert Dalek, who wrote a great book on Kissinger and Nixon, he's a historian, said you could look at every foreign policy initiative of Nixon and Kissinger, and you can't find one that wasn't also used for domestic gain. In particular, Nixon and Kissinger were very concerned with keeping the right wing in the Republican Party or winning over Southern racists from the Democratic Party. They had their eye on 1972. The Southern strategy, in other words, had a foreign policy component, and that was Cambodia, that was Laos, that was support for white supremacy in Southern Africa. Kissinger was constantly being dispatched to calm down and appease movement conservatives, including Ronald Reagan, who was governor of California. During one meeting with Reagan, he was trying to convince Reagan that it actually made a difference that Nixon, rather than a Democrat, was in office. He said, "We wouldn't have had Cambodia if it was Humphrey. We wouldn't have had Laos." You know, again, so Cambodia and Laos, the destruction of Cambodia and Laos are put for domestic political gain. Now, obviously, other presidents and administrations had used war and foreign policy for domestic benefit, but the late 60s and 70s is a kind of qualitative shift in which the increasing polarization, foreign policy, and not just foreign policy, but militarism, war, threats of war, and saber-rattling are increasingly needed to hold together and bring together and bind a conservative, the rising new right. Another element of the restored imperial presidency or the rehabilitated national security state is the deployment of ever more spectacular displays of violence to shock and awe a war-weary and skeptical citizenry, a point I'll come back to later. But neither covert operations nor political opportunism were Kissinger's chief contribution to the post-Vietnam resurgence of American militarism. Rather, Kissinger's main legacy is metaphysical. Now, conventional wisdom opposes Henry Kissinger to the neoconservatives who drove us into Iraq in 2003 and Afghanistan in 2002. Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld. Kissinger's sober realism is said to be of a different philosophical tradition than the heady arrogance of an administration that thought that the United States was so powerful that it could make reality. I don't know if you remember that famous quote that the journalist Ron Suskin took from a Bush staffer that many now believe was Karl Rove, that, you know, the United States is an empire now, and when we act, we make reality. You live in a reality-based community. You're busy recording your facts and data, and judiciously as you will. But as you're doing that, we're going to be acting again, and we're going to be making reality. Right? That's a quote that many took to illustrate what was said to be a kind of blind arrogance of the Bush administration. And it is true that many of the most prominent neoconservatives in the last days of the Ford administration did use Kissinger as a foil. They said that he was an appeaser for detente. They said he was a loser because of Vietnam. And they said he was a sinner because he supposedly didn't believe in American morality or American righteousness. Dick Cheney and others had a morality plank inserted into the Republican platform in 1976 that was understood to be an anti-Kissinger plank. But I think conventional wisdom that opposes the neocons to Kissinger is wrong. I think there's a misrecognition of Kissinger, and I think in that misrecognition, it's a useful pedagogy. There's an education there in that misrecognition. If realism is taken as a view of the world that holds that reality is transparent and that the truth of facts can be arrived at from simply observing those facts, then Kissinger was decidedly not a realist. Of all of the policymakers who helped construct the post-World War II national security state, Kissinger, born in Germany, was perhaps the most self-aware of the philosophical underpinnings of his diplomacy, of his actions. He was deeply influenced by an anti-rationalist and extremely subjectivist strand of German metaphysics that, considering how often it was used Kissinger used it to justify war and more war, bombing and more bombing, we might call imperial existentialism. In Kissinger's shadow, I explore how this romanticism manifested itself in Kissinger's specific policies, and in particularly in the bombing of Cambodia. And then once he left office, in his ongoing and consistent effort to militarize the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. But here are some of its major beliefs: that action creates our perception of reality. Reality might exist. Kissinger wasn't a solipsist, but he believed that there was reality, but he believed we had no access to the reality. Our understanding and perception of that reality was based on our own experience, and that it was through our action in the world that we came to an understanding of reality. That the past has no meaning other than what we in the present assign to it, and that the future is undetermined. That the greatest of great statesmen are aware of this freedom and refuse to be paralyzed by the past or held captive by an overabundance of data and intelligence produced by modern bureaucracies. They act on hunches and intuition, and they thrive on, as Kissinger wrote in 1954, perpetual creation, a constant redefinition of goals. It is the responsibility of true leaders, he said, not only to maintain the perfection of order, but to have the strength to contemplate chaos, there to find material for fresh creation. That kind of German irrationalism is often associated with Nietzsche, but in Kissinger's undergraduate thesis, which he submitted in 1950, which was the longest undergraduate thesis ever submitted in Harvard, it was 400 pages, a long meditation on Kant, on Spengler, on Toynbee, Alfred Toynbee, Immanuel Kant. The person that he's most drawn to is Oswald Spengler. Spengler was a very influential historian slash philosopher writing in the early 20th century, and he's very well known for having a schema of the rise and decline of civilizations. And according to Spengler, you can chart out the moment of decline of great civilizations. The moment of decline is when the economists and the bookkeepers and the accountants and the bureaucrats take over from the priests and the poets and the warriors. When civilizations forget why they are projecting power, they only know that they can project power, right? Power becomes instrumentalized. We lose our sense of purpose. We lose our sense of our understanding of our own selves and our own role in society and in history. Kissinger was extremely influenced by Spengler, but he rejected Spengler's determinism. Spengler was a deep pessimist. He believed that there was no turning back once the fact men or the causality men take over. The decline is inevitable. Kissinger in 1950, and then throughout his academic and policy career, would constantly insist that you could intervene in history, that you could reverse the trend, you could push the curve upwards, that decline wasn't inevitable. I mean, reading Kissinger's undergraduate thesis, one is reminded, or at least I am more than anything else, of a kind of post-war existentialism. Kissinger is constantly talking about the relationship between necessity and freedom. He sounds very much like Jean-Paul Sartre, who he cites in his bibliography, whose existentialism is a humanism, a famous influential essay that laid out the terms of what would be post-war existentialism, was translated into English a few years earlier, and Kissinger read and cited. But what's interesting about Kissinger, again, is where other existentialists, or where existentialism went on to influence the new left in the 1960s to protest war, to protest colonialism, to protest power, Kissinger puts it to defend war, to defend militarism, and to defend power. And I think that that's one of the things that's interesting about Kissinger.
You're listening to Greg Grandin on Kissingerism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Kissinger is best known for the concept of balance of power. But there's a fascinating and rarely cited passage, not in his undergraduate thesis, but in his graduate thesis, 1954 doctoral dissertation, where he insists that what he means by this is not real power. He writes that a balance of power legitimated by power would be highly unstable and make unlimited wars almost inevitable. For equilibrium is achieved not by the fact, but by the awareness of power, by the consciousness of power.